Well, today marks exactly 6 months since a national state of disaster was declared by South Africa, and on Friday, 6 months since the pandemic was declared by the World Health Organization. Since then, the global economy has slipped into recession. Millions have lost their jobs, prompting central banks around the world to launch unprecedented stimulus. Here at home, we entered the pandemic already in recession, and as last week's GDP print showed, we're now firmly in depression territory. COVID cases are dropping dramatically, and the fatality rate is nowhere near what the official models had predicted. Bringing the economy out of its induced coma as swiftly as possible is now priority number one. And as we await the move to level one, let's welcome our panel today. We were supposed to welcome Rudy Dix, head of the new project management office in the presidency, which reports directly to President Ramaphosa, but he had to rush off to an urgent meeting at NEDLAC to finalize the Eskom social compact for this afternoon. So I guess that means we can expect some more Eskom news later. We are joined by Martin Kingston, chair of the steering committee of Business for South Africa. He also serves as Business Unity SA's Vice President, and his day job is as Executive Chair of NM Rothschild's SA Division. Lebogang Moloyutsi, who is COSATU's Labour Market Policy Coordinator, and Annabel Bishop, Investec Chief Economist. Martin, perhaps it's worth just taking a step back to the risk-adjusted levels approach and to clearly define what we were trying to achieve as we move into level one, and what are we moving into when we talk about level one. I was walking around the shopping mall over the weekend, and it looks like we're in level zero already.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Michael. The need to open up the economy is now paramount, but without in any way compromising our health or indeed the health of our citizenry more broadly. And of course, level two effectively enables us to operate pretty freely as an economy, obviously under curfew and with our borders still sealed. We think that tourism needs to be reactivated as a matter of urgency, not just domestic and regional tourism, but international tourism. It's a very critical source of foreign exchange. It generates large amounts of employment. The industry obviously has been decimated by the pandemic over the past 6 months. So we need to move to level one so that we can achieve those objectives. But as I said, at no time putting at risk our nation in terms of the transmission of the virus. And what we have seen, as you and I were discussing earlier, has been a very significant drop-off, both in infection rates and mortality rates. We're either very lucky or we've been very far-sighted. Certainly, the hard lockdown helped us. We advocated that, not just as business, but all social partners. We could have come out of it perhaps more quickly and more efficiently, but like every other country around the world, we're learning as we move forward. And I think all the signs are positive. We've probably got another 6 months now before there's a subsequent surge. We need to make the absolute most of that set of circumstances by changing the direction and trajectory of the economy. And moving to level one is an absolutely crucial step in that process.
What do we mean by level one? Let's just stay on that for a second longer, Martin. Does that mean lifting the curfew as well as opening international borders? What might a level one bring?
Well, those are the two major areas which can be changed. I mean, others might say going to nightclubs as well. We wouldn't necessarily advocate that. Increasing the number of people who can participate in public gatherings is certainly under review. At the end of the day, all of this is at the discretion of government and the Corona Council, come on, as well as cabinet. But we do think, Michael, that effectively, with the exception of tourism, as I said in the curfew, most of the economy is now wide open.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Martin. Your signal is just breaking up. I thought you had concluded. Lebogang, speaking of the National Coronavirus Command Council, it's evaluating input from all the social partners and proposals on how we reintroduce economic activity. What is Labour's suggestion to get the economy growing again as we move to level one? Last week we saw just how desperate the situation is, and I'm sure among your members you can relay stories on how difficult the situation is on the ground for workers. So what would you like to see as Labour?
First and foremost, your intro was definitely spot on. We went into a self-induced coma for a period of 6 months. And if the GDP numbers are anything to go by it, we need to see, we need to see an expansion of economic activity, almost wanting 100% lifting on any constraint on economic activity now. You are quite right. The impacts have been quite significant, especially on the labor movement. When companies start to experience distress, the first things that are on the line are the jobs of workers. So we've seen a number of layoffs. The CCMA is inundated with a number of Section 189 notices to lay off their workers. So we want to see a complete lifting of any restriction on economic activity, which will also include opening of the borders. The tourism sector, like Martin rightfully alludes to, tourism and hospitality have been hit the most. They are currently in a state of distress. And if we don't do anything about that sector, it will be very difficult to see it come back online in the speed that we would like. So before anything happens any worse than what we've seen in the sector, we need to start having an earnest discussion about what we need to do now in the interim to keep this sector going so that we can see the levels of productivity and growth that we've seen in the sector in years.
And at the same time, ensuring that we keep the spread of the virus in check, because you're certainly not going to be bringing international tourists into the country if you do experience a significant uptick and increase in new infections. Annabel, from your perspective, what would you like to see implemented to speed up growth as we enter into level one?
Look, I think everything Lebong certainly said. The great concern we have is that, this recession has been very self-imposed in the second quarter. Contraction of around 50%, we certainly anticipated it. But the reality of the situation is, there have been some surveys showing that job losses could have been up to 3 million. That takes you to an unemployment rate of 42% for the second quarter. And of course, I was thinking of the next million, but of course, even if you use 1.7 million instead of 3 million, it takes you to an unemployment rate of 37%. Now that's unprecedented. It's extreme, and it's very crippling for the economy. The state-induced recession obviously has seen these huge job losses. We need to recover as quickly as possible to get people back into employment. Globally, the IMF has said 400 million full-time jobs were lost. And of course, that again is another very extreme number. If we have a look inside Africa, even if we are seeing about 1.7, 1.8 million jobs lost and we get only an unemployment rate of 37%, it needs to be a temporary once-off quarter. And, bringing back, certainly reducing the restrictions, but bringing back to some of the key points in South Africa where we have weak economic fundamentals is also vitally important. I think we're probably doing as much as we can on the electricity front because the problems are structural and they're going to take a very long time to repair. But we've seen the National Command Council move very rapidly with legislation under the lockdown restrictions, and I think the same should now be done to recharge the economy, and we should move very rapidly to eliminate a lot of red tape that is actually holding back business activity or just preventing people from doing business because of the failure to be able to get a lot of the environmental clearance certificates they need. We need increased productivity in the civil service and, as I said, cutting red tape. So these are all factors which improve the ease of doing business and therefore improve economic growth and recovery.
And it dovetails with what noted economist Ricardo Hausmann was saying. Martin, in an address last week on South Africa's economic stagnation, he identified a few key areas, and one of them is regulatory oversight that is potentially weak in other sectors of the economy, apart from financial services. He says our financial services sector is very well regulated. If you look elsewhere, and he's probably looking at ICASA, looking at NERSA as well, and a few other regulators, we do seem to suffer from regulatory failure. Would you say that we need a similar national state of disaster type approach to unblocking regulatory hurdles as we move forward, taking the lessons from the last 6 months? As I said, it's been exactly 6 months since we entered this national state of disaster. Maybe that's going to be the catalyst to get us out of it.
Michael, that's absolutely correct. In fact, Lebogang and I have been involved in exactly those discussions with government and the other social partners. And there is absolute commitment that we need to eradicate many of the constraints that are regulatory constraints if we're going to create the right sort of environment to ensure that we can completely change the trajectory for inclusive economic growth, in particular for those who have been and continue to be the most disadvantaged in South African society, the enablement of small and medium-sized enterprises to grow and to flourish, the red tape that Annabel has talked about being removed. We've had extremely explicit discussions with government, and we have identified step by step, regulation and law by regulation law, what needs to be done. And we've agreed an aggressive time frame. In fact, that is exactly what we will be discussing when we brief President Ramaphosa, that there is an acknowledgement and an understanding amongst all of the social partners as to the steps that urgently need to be taken to avoid what I have to characterize as a potential catastrophe in the making, which is what Annabel has talked about when we talk about the levels of unemployment, the contraction in GDP, and indeed the inability of the state to provide the requisite support to those who are most vulnerable on an even greater scale than has been required until now.
Martin, on the issue of that, and Annabel will come back to that point now, but I just want to stay on the capacity issue inside the state for a while longer. That's certainly what Ricardo Hausmann has touched on. And I think to an extent the president alluded to in his conversation, his virtual meeting with SANEF editors last week. What is the private sector doing to help provide a pool of resources that are unencumbered by any potential conflicts of interest that the state could then lean on to help unblock some of those capacity constraints inside the public sector?
Well, it's not actually just the private sector. I think it's all social partners. I think that the community at large needs to avail resources with the requisite skills and expertise to support the state at not only national but at provincial, and particularly it's been re-emphasized to us at local level, without, as you say, a conflict of interest. Is fundamentally on the table, not just the mobilization of financial resources to enable us to have the stimulus that's required to support economic activity, but indeed the skills and capabilities that are lacking and deficient currently in the public sector. The president has been very clear that's his number one constraint. It's not just going to have to come from business, it's going to have to come from everybody, and we're going to have to sanitize it in such a manner that there is no conflict of interest, that there is transparency and accountability for the work that's being performed.
Annabel, to come back to you, you wanted to respond to Martin's point?
I just wanted to add to it, rather. You know, and Martin, you know, absolutely key, I think, as well, and, you know, something that really needs to be raised also is the fact that we've got three real big problems. You know, one problem is that your Department of Tourism and Environmental Affairs is also your Department of Business Development, you know, of Economic Development, and you're finding many foundries and smelters in the South African economy unable to get their environmental clearance certificates, whether it's air clearance, whether it's other pollution certificates. And, you know, a second problem, very problematic as well in this industrial centre, because we have seen massive deindustrialization, and that means a huge loss of decent jobs, and as a consequence, decent salaries. And that means that our manufacturing sector, of course our mining and electricity, but really the manufacturing sector is getting a lot smaller. And, you know, one of the key problems there as well is that we actually need to change the environment which many small and medium enterprises actually operate in. The legislation on the industrial center, particularly manufacturing, foundries, smelters I've been talking about, has actually been cut and paste internationally and really is very applicable to large industries, not to smaller micro industries. And of course, you see many of these industries getting held up by the third crucial point, which is problems in terms of the regulators themselves. Government officials saying that you are compliant, that you don't need an air clearance certificate, then you do need one, a very environmental certificate, then you don't need one, then you do need one, and then suddenly you are liable. The big problem here is that a number of business owners, directors, they are personally liable. They get criminally charged due to mistakes that have been made in the government departments in terms of these clearance certificates. And of course, then this is a huge disincentive for investment in the economy. It's a huge disincentive for many to carry on their businesses, but it actually results in many businesses' failures as well, because the department then says, well, either you can close down your operations or you're liable for these fines. This is something that's a real, genuine issue. That's not getting airtime. That's not being broadcast. That actually is killing off the foundry industry and the smelter industry. And of course, you know, applying a fine of $500,000, $600,000 to a very tiny operation, well, that's going to be more than their operating profit for the year. And this has been due to enormous bureaucratic bungling of the application of the regulations. But also, of course, another point, as we talked about earlier, the incredible intense complexity of these regulations. massive burden of them. And of course, the fact, as we said, that many of them come from overseas and the regulators themselves are battling to interpret and apply them. And these are all really, really crucial issues. If we are actually genuinely very honest that we do want to get this industry going forward. If not, if we're not going to change this regulatory environment, which is suppressing the recovery of these sectors, then I'm afraid we're not going to see a good, strong recovery in economic growth. And that's my biggest fear. Next year, we see growth of maybe 1, 2% again or less.
Lebogang, from Labour's vantage point, it was about a month ago that Nahawu was threatening to go on strike over the issue around civil servant wages. That rhetoric seems to have died down, certainly from my vantage point. Where are we in terms of those negotiations, very critical negotiations between public sector workers and the state?
I think the main thing that underpins the debacle between government as well as Nahawu is the principle around honoring collective bargaining agreements. I think that is the crux of the matter. It's just around the issue of restoring the trust that trade unions workers have with government. When you set out an agreement, a three-year collective bargaining agreement, you cannot at the last stage of the agreement or the last year of implementing the agreement then renege on the agreement. But that is really at the crux of what the issue is, providing that trust between trade unions and the government. That trust is actually quite important, Michael, especially if we're going to talk about issues of entering into an economic recovery. You need to have that trust between workers as well as the government. There are a number of things that the labor movement can bring on board towards a collective agreement that sees us taking an economic recovery forward. But we can only commit to such things when we don't lack a trust deficit with government. I think another thing that I wanted to quickly respond to that Annabelle was talking to, another thing that really drives us as organized labor, especially in our deliberations to see an economic recovery, is how we look at getting sectors that are labor intensive online. So how do we look at getting particularly manufacturing, how do we particularly look at getting manufacturing because it's labor intensive? How do we look at increasing localization in South Africa? What products do we generally have a relative advantage in producing that we can start to produce in South Africa so that we can start to see the type of job creation that we want to see unfold as part of their economic recovery? So those things are important. And another thing that Annabelle talked about that I really liked, at the crux of the matter, at the crux of the issues that are some of the contentious issues, especially within this debacle between the public wages sector, the public sector wage bill, is around how do we ensure that workers get a decent wage? How do we ensure that they get a decent living? And how do we do that, balancing that with the economic recovery trajectory that we're trying to go into?
I think on that last point, Annabelle, there are calls for the 350 Rand grant to remain in place long after permanently from October when it was due to end, and the economic arguments being that if you're at least supporting those who weren't earning any income, they will start spending that back into the economy and that will be a catalyst for growth. What are your thoughts on that in a fiscal environment where we're running close to a debt to GDP level of almost 100%? How is that going to be funded?
Look, I think maybe just from a humanitarian perspective, providing people with a stipend to be able to afford some food each month is, you know, something which would be enormously welcoming. And for me, that would be something I'd enormously encourage. I think the problem is not necessarily the fault of the unemployed, the workers, etc., but here of government in terms of having a decade of massive overspending where monies were wasted, looted, and of course inefficiently spent. We have entered this huge collapse in GDP, is another way to call it, of the second quarter, with a decimated government finances. Now, if we had not had those 10 years, the Zuma decade, if we carried on from the Thabo Mbeki years where we ran a fiscal surplus, where unemployment was at 21%, and you carried on with the exceptionally good governance that the Thabo Mbeki presidency brought to South Africa, and not had these wasted 10 years, we lost over $1 trillion in economic growth, sure, but economic output, sure, but we lost close to 9% from an unemployment perspective, moving from 21% to 30%. This is the big problem. And then, of course, now the fact that we don't obviously have the money to provide the economic stipend, yes, the social welfare stipend of 350 Rand a month, yes, but also the economic stimulus and recovery, which many other countries around the world are providing. And in fact, you know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of action about trying to relieve low-income economies of debt. Now, South Africa is probably at risk of falling into a low-income economy because we have lost so many jobs, because GDP has collapsed, because your GDP per capita will have been negatively impacted. But also, of course, as well, we're not going to have any debt relief. Now, we are facing credit rating downgrades. We are facing higher borrowing costs. Our bond yields have started to tick up. And all of this actually brings us closer to a fiscal cliff, which is not being taken seriously by government. The government will say we can't provide this 350 rand a month, which will have the multiplier effects you want, which you allude to, because of the fiscal problems. And to me, this is a hugely problematic environment, which has been self-inflicted by incredibly poor governance of the past decade.
And I think the finance minister, writing in the Sunday Times over the weekend, tried to spin a positive narrative. He said it's Operation Vulindlela time, opening up. The problem is, we heard that roughly a year ago, Martin, and I think we're back to square one, back at the negotiating table, seeking another deal. Why is it that we just cannot implement what seems so obvious to so many?
Well, I believe, Michael, we've wanted to have our cake and eat it as a country, and now we've come to the stark realization that we can't. Vulindlela is no different than implementing the structural reforms that we've all agreed are absolutely essential if we're going to be able to reposition economic trajectory on an inclusive and a sustainable basis, exactly as Annabelle has discussed, to bring all of those who are unemployed into the mainstream of the economy, as Lebo Khang has talked about. That requires fundamental reform. It requires us to live within our means. As Annabelle has indicated, our debt to GDP levels are completely untenable in terms of the debt service cost, with a reducing, by the way, tax base, which we also need to acknowledge. And to do all of this, we need to raise significant amounts of capital, both domestically and internationally. We've said we need to do that jointly, not just government. Government itself needs to be aligned. It must speak with a single voice, but it also needs to work with its social partners if we're going to be able to mobilize that capital, both domestically and internationally, in, I have to say, very stiff competition from other countries that also are, if you like, in an invidious position as a consequence of the pandemic. We mustn't forget that Africa itself is going to have been very badly impacted by what is going on. I don't believe, Michael, that the markets are going to any longer give South Africa the benefit of the doubt. We've made that absolutely clear in all of our engagements. When I say we, I'm not just speaking for business. I think Labour equally has made it clear that we have no chance. We're in the last chance saloon, effectively. We have the medium-term budget policy statement coming up in about 4 weeks' time. I don't think we can wait to kick the can down the road till next February's budget. We're going to have to spell out very clearly on a zero-based budgeting approach how we're going to curtail our expenditure, grow our revenue, and focus on approaches and interventions that can actually include the majority of our people in the economy through, as Lebo Khang has said, localization. We've committed as a business to a massive localization program. But all of this takes time. My concern, actually, is what happens in the immediate short term, in the aftermath of the pandemic, when we get into 2021. The pandemic itself, of course, won't have left us. We'll still have restrictions. We'll still have viral transmission. And an economy that, as Annabelle has said, has been decimated, not just, by the way, by the pandemic, but by poor governance, poor decisions, and zero implementation has been effective in the past several years.
We have seen some, and Lebo Khang, perhaps just to end on the other side of the coin, a slightly more positive note, there has been some spark. We've seen in the power sector the fact that almost 11,000 megawatts will now be procured, starting with the REIPPP bid window 5, most likely in December. We've also seen the president in that meeting with SANEF last week bemoan the fact that ICASA kicked out the spectrum auction until the first quarter of next year. There does seem to be a real frustration inside the presidency. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be spilling over into some of the other line ministries. Is there anything as Labour that gives you confidence that this time is different, that this time we will walk away from the negotiation table and actually implement some of these reforms?
So the nice thing about hitting rock bottom, which I feel we're there, is that there's really nowhere else for us to go. I think Martin clearly mentions the point that this is really our last chance. And I think various social partners realize that. Not only will the investor community not give us another chance after this, But the domestic individuals in South Africa are looking to give this government, these leaders, a last chance. And I don't think there's anything else that we can say after this. There's really no negotiation about the rebuilding process. Everybody has to pull their weight. There are people who are sitting at home that have been displaced, that no longer have a job, that cannot feed their children. And I don't think they'll be listening to sloganeering after this period. We are looking to rebuild. We are looking to give people the hope that they require to understand that this is, you know, we're moving forward. I think over and above 1994, we're at a serious four-way stop in the country, and we need to move forward. And I do believe that the government, especially the administration led by President Ramaphosa, realize that we are at this four-way stop. That really we need to move forward, and we need to take all social partners with us as we move forward. Because I don't think South Africans are going to give us another chance after this if we don't get this process right.
Absolutely. People are hungry, and you can't eat plans and promises coming out of NEDLAC.